Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is life like for members of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? The 2008 raid on the Yearning for Zion compound of the FLDS Church put this small splinter group in national headlines after an anonymous tip to authorities alleging that underage girls were being forced into marriage. That tip was later found out to be placed not by a 16-year-old sexual abuse victim, but by a 33-year-old Colorado woman without direct ties to the group. But publicity over the case, including the ultimate return home of hundreds of children who had been placed in foster care, has sparked great curiosity over the reality of life within the FLDS, particularly its commitment to the principle of plural marriage for some families. Active members of the faith tend to be quite isolated from the outside world, residing often on rural compounds in a handful of U.S. states. But journalist and novelist Scott Anderson has spent considerable time with them and has written an extraordinary account for the February issue of National Geographic magazine called The Polygamist, an exclusive look inside the FLDS. Scott, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to be here.
Can you start by telling us what it took to get permission to be there in the first place?
It largely came about by the photographer I worked with, Stephanie Sinclair. She, in the immediate aftermath of the Texas raid in 08, she was one of the only photographers to get inside the YFC ranch and to be able to photograph there. And so she approached the FLDS leadership about doing an article for National Geographic where we would spend a lot more time. And Stephanie spent probably a good portion of the last year and a half going to different FLDS compounds, and I've spent less time than that, but I think I made 5 trips out there.
Were there any sort of conditions placed on your time within the community and to whom you could speak and about what?
No, none. But what was interesting was clearly the permission given to us was cleared by Warren Jeffs himself, the prophet of the FLDS, who's in prison. And that permission tended to fluctuate. It tended to kind of come and go. So one day we would have extraordinary access. We'd be going into people's houses. They'd be talking about their living arrangement, how many wives they had, how many children. And then literally the next day, access kind of closed down, and we never could really quite figure out why. But we could just be sitting in our hotel room for 2 or 3 days until it opened back up again.
I'm curious about the response to Stephanie, given that in the FLDS community, a woman's primary role is to bear children and sort of multiply. Were they bothered by the fact that this was a woman with a professional career that took her away from whatever family she might have?
No, I don't think so. It's something I've noticed. I've covered war and I've spent a lot of time in third world countries over the years. And one thing I've always noticed is that often women journalists, photojournalists, and writers can actually have better access because they are taken less seriously because in a sexist culture, women are considered a bit less. They're not posed as big a threat, and so the irony is that often they can get a much better access.
Another thing that really struck me about your piece was your observation that women in the FLDS communities that you visited seem to be more confident, more outspoken, all around sort of in a better position in some ways than men.
That's right. I think when I first went into the FLDS compounds and towns, I naturally in my mind was comparing it to time I've spent in the Middle East, because it's one other place where polygamy is very accepted. And of course, in the Middle East, women are very much in the background. If you even see them at all, usually if there's a male visitor to the house, they're sequestered in another part of the house. And what immediately struck me, it continued through all my trips there, was that in general, the women in the FLDS tended to be much more articulate and really more self-confident, I found, than the men. I found often trying to talk with men kind of like trying to pull teeth. And it took me a long time to sort of figure out why this might be. And my conclusion is that when you have a you have a society where women are coveted because people want plural wives, it does give them this a certain power. Whereas with men, they're in competition with each other to stay on the good side of the prophet, because the prophet has to okay any marriages, and mathematically the odds are stacked against you if another man has 7 or 8 or 10 or 20 wives. So I think men learn very quickly that, you know, the best thing to do is keep a low profile. And with women in the FLDS certainly don't do that.
Did people there seem happy?
Yeah. You know, it's a very hard thing to judge. And I, of course, people who were talking to us were very aware they were talking with a journalist. And I think that this is a group that feels so besieged from the outside that I think there's a natural tendency to want to put the best face forward on everything. I had several women talk to me about the difficulties they'd had in accepting plural marriage when their husband came to them and said that they wanted to take on another wife, and they talked about it really rather articulately. As far as happy, there's a very much of a kind of a wholesome life. I'm thinking specifically where I spent the most time, which was it used to be called Short Creek. It's this FLDS community right on the Arizona-Utah border. There's no TV. The children are homeschooled. They play. They do work from a very early age in the fields. You know, as an outsider looking at it, I would say it's a very wholesome environment. It's harder for me to judge whether it's happy or not.
Yeah, I guess it's hard. I mean, it's hard to tell that about the people on your own street.
Right.
There's some really interesting dichotomies here, because you mentioned they don't have TV, and people are familiar from the news accounts of their very sort of simple, old-fashioned dress. But they're online. They've got businesses online. They have cell phones and cars.
That's right. I think that's one thing that people don't, a misconception that a lot of people have from having seen the footage of the FLDS, the raid on the YFC ranch back in 08. I think there's this notion that these people are you know, living in deep isolation and are really cut off from the outside world, and it's not true. Certainly, in Colorado City and Hilldale, these twin communities on the Utah-Arizona border, virtually everybody has cell phones. The women all drive. They routinely drive into the nearby towns to do grocery shopping. They're not isolated from the outside world in the way that I think a lot of people imagine.
Were you able to get a handle on how their non-FLDS neighbors, in the cases where there are any in 50 miles, how they feel about them?
Yeah, they talked about that. It's interesting. I think that especially with the mainstream Mormon population, with members of the LDS, they have a very difficult time. And there's a tremendous amount of friction between people in the FLDS and people in the LDS. People did talk about how when they would go grocery shopping in St. George, in Utah, that they'd be stared at, because they do have this kind of prairie style dresses they wear and the fancy hairstyles, and often. Like verbally abused by what they call Gentiles, and they always felt that was especially true among Mormons.
And I think most people are aware of this, but we'll just clarify: mainstream Mormons, the LDS Church, they excommunicated everyone practicing plural marriage about 100 years ago.
That's right,
and that's when the group splintered off. Is that the only argument that the FLDS has with the other tenets of the Mormon Church?
Well, from a theological point, they see themselves as the true inheritors of the Mormon Church, of Joseph Smith. They feel that they have stayed true to the teachings and the revelations that Joseph Smith received. The issue of plural marriage is probably the the biggest issue between them, because Joseph Smith said that this was a revelation from God and that it was to be an everlasting covenant. And they make the point, the FLDS makes the point, that an everlasting covenant can't just be canceled out for political reasons. And they feel that's what the LDS Church did in renouncing polygamy as a way to join the Union back in the 1890s.
Journalist and novelist Scott Anderson is my guest this hour. His article in the February 2010 issue of National Geographic magazine is called The Polygamists, an exclusive look inside the FLDS. We'll resume our conversation with Scott in just a couple of minutes and invite you to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Right now, we want to give you an update on the challenge grant that we have going for today's Think program. Jeff Whittington is in. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And Chris, we're making great progress. That doesn't mean don't call.
It means please call.
please call. Let's get this out of the way. Julie Pendery, a listener, a supporter, a very generous supporter of the station, has offered a $2,500 challenge grant. If we can receive 100 donations, if we manage to convince 100 of you to give, 100 discreet individuals to give a contribution in any amount to KERA during the noon to 2 p.m. Think block today. And Chris, we've heard from almost 70 people. We've got 31 contributions left to go to make this challenge, to be able to accept the $2,500. But I don't want...
You don't want the tortoise in the hare.
Well, yeah, and we don't want to get complacent here. We want to make sure that we emphasize how important it is that you go ahead and call now, 888-694-6931, or contribute online right now so that we can, you know, get that knocked out, get that extra $2,500, and keep moving on toward the end of this membership campaign.
Your contribution supports conversations like the one we're having right now with Scott Anderson. This is an hour-long, in-depth, serious discussion of a group of Americans, as opposed to a soundbite-laden sort of sniping from one side and the other, where all you really get is a sense of conflict. This is our show is dedicated to trying to understand things and really look into the ways that people form their lives and how they form their ideas. We're really proud to be able to bring you this kind of content. We know for a fact, I've worked at other radio and television stations, and this is the only one, bar none, where I could have this kind of conversation with a journalist of Scott Anderson's caliber and take it seriously. And we appreciate that you value the content. We know you do because you call, you email, you interact with the show. Your financial support, though, is the only thing that makes it possible. 1-888-694-6931 is our number. You can also make a contribution at kera.org.
We pride ourselves on being able to bring you conversations on this very show, even though it's just a local show. It is in the fifth media market in the country, but you know, it's a local show on a local public radio affiliate here in Dallas-Fort Worth. But we pride ourselves on being able to bring you conversations with preeminent journalists like Scott Anderson, preeminent thinkers like Dr. Nersessian in the first hour. We pride ourselves on being able to bring those people right to you so that you can call in, you can email in, you can interact with some of the greatest thinkers, some of the greatest writers that we have in society today. And that's what you're supporting when you call 888-694-6931. And, of course, also your contribution right now helps us meet this challenge and get the drive over that much sooner.
Thank you so much to Marius Hosu in Dallas, Randolph Scott in Tyler, Daniel Simino in Denton, excuse me, Prudence Sanchez in Denton, Patricia Noel in Grapevine, and Warren Broll in Frisco. We would love to read your name along with Michael Gravels, perhaps in Dallas, and Patty Shepherd in Arlington. Thank you to all of you. You are the ones who are making this possible. We have this challenge grant going. Consider yourself, if you make a contribution during the 2 hours of Think Today, consider yourself the person who allowed us to get this additional $2,500.
Yeah, we only need 31 more contributions at 888-694-6931. Let's go ahead and knock that out really quickly here. Make your call. Make your online contribution at kera.org. Do it right now. And don't forget the number, 888-694-6931.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist and novelist Scott Anderson is my guest this hour. His article in the National Geographic magazine issue for February of this year is called The Polygamists, an exclusive look inside the FLDS. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk here a little bit more about this concept of plural marriage, which, although we're calling it polygamy, in fact, it's polygyny because there aren't any women with five husbands in the culture. Am I correct?
No, there's not.
Yeah. What's the original justification for it as the FLDS members see it?
Well, the original justification goes back to this revelation that Joseph Smith claimed to have received in the early 1840s. And the notion was that as the saints, the living saints, that the Mormon people were to multiply and replenish the earth, and that the way to do that was for women to have as many children as possible, and for men to have as many wives as could facilitate that. That revelation was kept quiet, although people found out about it, and it pretty much directly led to Joseph Smith's assassination. But it wasn't publicly revealed to the Mormon people or to the world at large until the Mormons went to Utah in the late 1840s, early 1850s, and that's when Brigham Young came out with it publicly. So for about 30, 40 years in Utah, it was openly practiced, and it became a huge social issue in this country to the point where it almost led to a war. With federal troops coming into Utah to dismantle this theocracy that had been created, as a condition of joining the Union of becoming a state, the Mormon leadership was told that they had to ban polygamy, and so when they came out with the proclamation in the 1890s, you saw this schism occur between people who said, well, it wasn't a true revelation. Renouncing polygamy, it was just done for political reasons, and that's really when you started to see the split between the mainstream Mormon church and fundamentalist groups like the FLDS.
And in terms of law enforcement today, Scott, my understanding is that they are very concerned about underage girls and people being forced into marriage, but do they turn a sort of blind eye to consenting adults who want to live this way?
They always have. This community of Hilldale in Colorado City on the Utah-Arizona border, it's been a polygamous community since about the 1920s. It became a gathering place for polygamous moving from Salt Lake City and places north. Both the state of Utah and Arizona at different times conducted raids, would arrest people for illegal cohabitation. They could never get a woman to testify that yes, she was in a polygamous marriage, and all these raids tended to end up being embarrassments for the authorities. And so, really, the last really significant raid was in the early 1950s, and so for well over 50 years, people were living quite openly in polygamous families there.
Forgive me for asking a personal question, but are you married or have you been married?
I am married,
okay.
Yes.
Did the relationships that you witnessed there, did they resemble in any way what you know to be sort of a normal marriage?
It's a good question. Yes, they did. I have to say it was one of the most unusual experiences I've had. He's actually the man who's on the... On the cover of the National Geographic, a man named Joe Jessup, who's very elderly now, he's in his 80s, and he has five wives. I spent a lot of time with Joe. I went into the house, I met all the wives, and the relationship between him and each of his wives that I observed seemed very much like a husband and wife. Really odd moment in hanging out with Joe was realizing that two of his wives were a mother and daughter. The the mother had been widowed and married Joe, and then her daughter did about 6 months later. So that was kind of unusual.
You also attended a funeral for one of his wives, is that right?
A different man, yes.
Okay. Merrill Jessup.
Merrill Jessup, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was an extraordinary affair, thousands of people.
Yeah, there was probably about 7,000 or 8,000 people turned out. And the viewing of the wife went on for about 8 hours over. It started on one evening and it continued the next day. And just everybody came by. It was this never-ending procession.
And this is something that happens often when someone dies in the community.
Yes, my guide to the community. I thought Merrill Jessup is one of the top leaders of the FLDS, and so the funeral was for his first wife, and so I assumed that this huge outpouring, people were coming in from all over the American West, and as far as from British Columbia to attend this funeral. And I asked Sam, this man who was my guide, I just assumed that it was because of Merrill Jessup's prominence in the church. He said, "Oh no, this is a regular occurrence." In fact, Sam he had a little boy who had died about a few years earlier, and Sam didn't tell me this, but I heard that over 5,000 people attended that funeral. So it's a society where that tends to gather at these times where at times of birthdays and funerals, and you see this amazing coming together.
So this was the funeral for Merrill Jessup's first wife. Is there an obvious hierarchy among the wives according to when they were brought into the relationship?
Not that I know of, no. I don't think so, and I have asked about that. What tends to happen with the wives is they tend to divide the household. Certainly, I think that the wives who are senior have it's kind of like a sorority. It's like the fourth year sorority girls can order the other ones around. But they tend to divide up the household chores, seemingly usually by aptitude. If somebody likes to cook and is a good cook, they tend to run the kitchen. Somebody else might do the finances and the shopping. They make their own clothes, so there might be another wife who sees to mending clothes and things of that nature. It's hard. Other people have said that there is very much this hierarchy within the family among the wives. People I talked to said that it was usually very harmonious.
Did you sense that women think less of themselves as women in terms of their intellect and their abilities in the world? Obviously, their sort of division of responsibilities is very different within the FLDS than it is in the broader United States. But did you get that sense?
No, I have to say I didn't. It may go back to what I was saying earlier, how the men struck me as being much less self-confident and less articulate than the women. But the interesting thing is that the women in the community tend to be better educated than the men. It's exclusively done at home in Hilldale and in Colorado City now. But the boys often go off to work from about the age of 11 or 12, mm-hmm. and so their schooling pretty much with very many of them ends at that point, where I think the women, by staying at home, have more access to reading, to the internet, and so if anything, I think that in general the women fancy themselves more clever than the men.
There's also the issue that because there's such competition for women, and there are too many men, if certain men are going to have multiple wives, that young men often will be sort of excommunicated from the group or shunned and no longer welcome to live there.
That's right. They're called the Lost Boys of the FLDS, and it's a very controversial topic, and you hear radically different claims of how many Lost Boys there are. Some people, people in the FLDS say it's a very small number. People who are social workers who are involved in trying to help these kids say there's hundreds of them. Basically, what happens is that, you know, young boys, teenagers who rebel, are maybe given a chance to see the error of their ways and repent, but are often just cast out. And there have been cases of boys as young as 13 just being asked to leave the community and kind of left to fend for themselves. And again, because this is such a closed community, these boys are going off really without very many, you know, life management skills. And there have been a few cases of them, you know, getting into problems with drugs, male prostitution, things like that.
It's hard to imagine their parents being willing to let them go. Is that really an example of the influence that the church elders have?
Yes, and I think especially of the prophet of Warren Jeffs. If a fiat comes down from Warren Jeffs saying somebody has to go, it is remarkable. I mean, this is one of the things that is certainly gives pause about this group is the extraordinary power that Warren Jeffs has. That you would think that as an outsider, you'd think that if you heard from the prophet or one of his lieutenants that your son has to leave the community, you would think that parents would resist, but often they don't. Similarly, in the same vein, this whole issue of reassignment, where the prophet can get a revelation and decide that the wives and the children of a man, that the man is no longer worthy, and he will take the wives and children away from them from the man and reassign them to another man. It's Warren Jeffs did this with around 20 families in 2004, and virtually all of them accepted. And presumably, some of those were happy marriages, but the wives and the children were just transferred to another man.
Journalist and novelist Scott Anderson is my guest. He has a new article in the February issue of National Geographic called The Polygamists, an exclusive look inside the FLDS. We'll resume our conversation with Scott in just a couple of minutes. Right now, first I'll give you the phone call, the phone number if you'd like to call us. It's 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Right now, though, we want to update you on the state of our challenge grant. Very, very generous listener Julia Pendery has given us a $2,500 challenge for today's Think program. We need to receive 100 contributions by 2 o'clock. That's the end of this hour. 21 left to go. Certainly possible. Your call will bring that number down, and then it starts to snowball. We would ask that you make it as soon as possible and perhaps encourage some other folks who've been holding off, wanted to be in that last 10 or 20. Our telephone number is 1-800-694-6931. You can also go online and make a contribution. It will count toward the challenge at kera.org. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris. Yeah, the number is 888-694-6931. It's 1-888-694-6931. You can join Cheryl Gigliotti in Fort Worth, Linda Somerville in Granbury, and Karen Elenick in Dallas. Thank you so much for your calls. Also to Candace Moss in Dallas, James Ellis in Euless, and is it Carrie Barnes or Sari Barnes in Allen? Thank you very much for your contributions at 888-694-6931.
Also want to say thank you to Frank Tarzi in Plano, Byron Kiyuko in Fort Worth, and DJ Cauley in Arlington. We would love to read your name next when you become a contributing member to KERA or make an additional gift. The number is 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org. Fascinating conversation this afternoon.
Yeah, I was just about to say that, Chris.
Well, Scott Anderson has so many interesting insights into this community, and it's great to be able to speak with a journalist like him who really has sort of done the time. He didn't just, you know, take a helicopter and try to survey things from 60,000 feet. He's made multiple visits to multiple communities to really try and understand and provide as honest as possible, you know, unvarnished either way, a portrait of these people that are really fascinating to a lot of people.
I've been a personal fan of Scott's journalism for a number of years, and he really does get his feet, you know, so to speak, get his feet dirty.
Yeah.
He gets on the ground and he finds out what the story is. And for us to be able to bring, you know, you the author of the cover story of National Geographic magazine, and to do it on a frequent basis, you know, it says a lot about the quality of this audience and about the quality of the experience that our guests have. Because when guests, you know, get done with the show, they go back, they tell the folks in the magazine, hey, the audience is pretty smart, you know, it was a good experience. Well, that's because we open the phones, we take your calls, we ask questions on your behalf. This is your public radio station, and this is your show on your public radio station, and that's why we're asking you to support it at 888-694-6931 or via the web at kera.org.
If you've ever gone anywhere where Jeff or I is speaking about our show and about the work, the first thing we boast about is the quality of the audience. True story. You know, we're excited to have great guests, and we really enjoy the work itself, but we are most excited about an audience that gets this kind of work. Not everybody is a public radio person. Not everybody wants to spend an hour really diving into topics that may relate directly to your life and may just be something really interesting. We are delighted that you are interested in the show and in the content of the show. We are also really proud to know that so many of you choose to support this with your dollars. It's one thing to sit there and listen and let someone else, you know, sit there on someone else's dime, essentially. But those of you who support the station are the ones that are really our heroes because you make it possible. The number is 1-888-694-6931. You can also make a contribution at kera.org.
Thanks very much to April Silbert and McKinney, Don Belusek in Richardson, and Karen Lewis in Dallas. They've made their contribution. Also, we hear from Tom Rogers in Colleyville and James and Cynthia Gertner in Dallas. They've called 888-694-6931, or they went online to kera.org, made a contribution. Chris, we just need 15 more contributions to make this challenge grant of $2,500 from Julia Pendry. So please be the next one to call or to contribute online.
Yes, help us to do this because it is possible that everybody listening will say, great, 15 other people will take care of it and then we'll be lost. You can make it possible. And when you make your call during this hour, consider that you're the one who put us over the top. You can think of it that way. We have this $2,500 challenge grant from Julia Pendry. If we receive a total of 100 contributions or more by 2 o'clock today, the telephone number 1-888-694-6931. You can also make a contribution online and check out thank you gifts at kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute with journalist Scott Anderson.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here with novelist and journalist Scott Anderson. His cover story for the February issue of National Geographic magazine is called The Polygamists, an exclusive look inside the FLDS. To join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We talked about reassignment before the break, Scott. Can you talk about assignment in the first place? How do a man and a woman decide that they want to marry each other, or do they decide?
I mean, this is something that has certainly changed within the FLDS in the last, say, two decades. I mean, I think it used to be done just kind of the way it happened in outer society, with the difference that men could take on more wives if they had the revelation that they should. What's happened in the last, say, 20 years of the FLDS, first with the Warren Jeffs' father, Rulon Jeffs, taking over, and then especially with Warren taking over, is it's become almost the exclusive province of the prophet himself, and he decides who should marry. So I think the way it works is you can certainly put in your preferences, or you can express an interest, but it's the prophet who decides who should marry.
And at what age are women in particular married?
Well, this is something that of course they've gotten into a lot of trouble with, and several men are now in have received long prison sentences for this very thing, including Warren Jeffs himself. So it's one thing they don't like to talk about. What they have, what one of the FLDS spokesmen told me was that there have been underage marriages in the past, but they're not happening anymore. If you do the math of how young some of the mothers are, certainly some of the women who were on who were picked up in the YFC raid were underage when they got married. Most of the women I met said that they had gotten married when they were 17 or 18 or a little bit older.
Is it hard to tell their ages when they're not wearing makeup and they're not dressed the way a teenage girl or a 20-something woman would be in sort of modern America?
Yeah, well, it is, but in fact, they're always made up. I mean, that's the funny thing. They always wear these—I call them prairie dresses. These kind of long dresses down to their ankles, and these very elaborate hairdos. So even and little girls are dressed like this, 4 or 5 years old. So I found it—I would find it quite difficult to tell. I would meet a wife, and it would be very hard for me to know, well, is she 15, is she 19? Because as an outsider, they there is a little bit that they look alike.
Yeah, with everyone wearing the same sort of dress and the same
right.
sort of hairstyle. Is there a proselytizing aspect to the culture? Did they try to convert you?
No. Mm-hmm. No. Certainly not with me. I mean, they took pains to try to explain their beliefs to me, and that's one thing about the FLDS. I think maybe at different times they have tried to proselytize a bit, and probably mostly with other other Mormon fundamentalists or other polygamists. But I think it's such a radical departure from most people's experience that I don't believe they ever have really tried to proselytize in the quote Gentile community.
Yeah, would they accept outsiders who hadn't been born into this? Could someone, show up on their doorstep and say, "I want to be part of the group"?
I think they'd be very suspicious
yeah.
of an outsider coming in. And I mean, it is a very closed off environment in that way. That they were very nice to me. They're very nice to Stephanie Sinclair because they were. They were under orders from the prophet to be, but they're a community that looks at the outside world with great suspicion. So as an outsider coming in and wanting to join, I think that wouldn't even be in their realm of logic. I think they would have a strange time with that.
I know that it's rare for people to leave, but you did speak to someone to some people who had done so. What's the experience like to have grown up in this and then try to make your way in the outside world?
Yeah, it's very difficult. And one thing I think it is important to get across because I think it goes back to this conception that a lot of people have of. From having seen the footage of the YFC raid, this idea that somehow people are being kept there against their will, it's much more subtle than that. It's coercive in the way any devout religious group is coercive, or any small society is coercive. That there are these pressures put on you to conform, to stay a part of the group. The difficulty with when you try to leave and you've been raised in this environment is that you really you're coming from such a in a lot of ways a kind of an 18th century mindset, and especially for women where they really do not make decisions for themselves. They as much as they can go to the grocery store or move around the vicinity, they're very much kind of isolated to the house, that they don't have the life skills to function. I interviewed Carolyn Jessup, who is probably the most famous person to have, quote, escaped from the FLDS, and she wrote a book about it. And she's now a very fierce critic of the FLDS. But she also made the point, you know, no one was putting a gun to her to keep her there. But the biggest problem with trying to leave was she just felt she was stepping out into a different universe. She'd never written a check. She had no idea about finances, no idea about really kind of very basic things that most people know about. So to step out into that world, I think, is incredibly frightening and daunting to people. I think it's also when you see with the Lost Boys, why so many of them become unmoored. It's they've never had the freedom of choices, the freedom to get into trouble that you know, it looms out there in the outside world.
And this is not even like Rumspringa that the Amish have, where they come back after they sort of leave. They're once they're banished, they're gone.
They're gone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never heard of a case of a lost boy coming back. I have heard of cases of women leaving for short times and then for one reason or another coming back. I think that often happens because if the children have stayed and they're staying within the church, they come back because they miss their children.
Scott, what kind of future do the members of the FLDS communities imagine for themselves? Do they see that they will sort of continue to endure into the next century?
They absolutely believe that. I wouldn't call it a martyr complex, but if you look at their history, and of course because they see themselves as the true inheritors of the Mormon Church, that if you look at the Mormon Church history, there is this long history of persecution, beginning with Joseph Smith's assassination and the wanderings of the Mormon people, throughout the American East, and then finally to Utah. So they see that ever since the 1830s, when the church started, that it has been a history of persecution from the outside, and they've always survived. They've always managed to continue on. They certainly feel under siege now, with after the raid in Texas and the prosecutions that have come down from that. With Warren Jeffs in prison and now facing more trials. But I think that everybody I talked to was completely confident that their faith would continue.
Very, very briefly, I know that you're also a novelist. Were there things that you experienced that made you think this would be great fodder for fictionalized work?
I think probably on a philosophical level, I got thinking on a thematic level. It's a fascinating case of what happens when a religious minority, in this case, has beliefs that the larger world finds abhorrent or scandalous, and who wins out, and who as outsiders. Who's to judge what is acceptable and what isn't? And obviously, there has to be a line drawn somewhere. But so I got very intrigued by that idea of what limits do you place on people's freedoms, and who gets to decide?
Scott Anderson's article for the February issue of National Geographic is called "The Polygamist: An Exclusive Look Inside the FLDS." Scott, it's a fascinating piece of work. Thank you very much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thank you, Chris. My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. We want to thank all of you who have been listening over the past hour, and in fact, the past 2 hours of Think. We also want to thank those of you who are helping us to chip away at this challenge grant that we have for today. We had started with a goal of 100 contributions during the 2 hours of Think. We have 10 to go in about 6 minutes. This is entirely possible to do with your support. Please help us to make this. We will receive from this amazing donor to KERA an additional $2,500 if we can reach our goal of 100 contributions.
Hey, Chris, I want to say thanks to Mike Walker in Southlake, Danny Cook in Fort Worth, Lauren McCracken in Fort Worth, David Allen in Grand Prairie, Erica Crutcher in Fort Worth, Jason Halavinka in somewhere, Lee Sanders in Fort Worth, Vicky Black in Allen, Don Dooley in Denton, Dennis Minotti in Southlake, and Rachel Stallings in Aledo. They've all made a contribution during
Excellent.
The show today. We have this $2,500 challenge on the table from Julia Pendry. We must receive a total of 100 donations by 2 o'clock. That's the minutes are, I mean, we're moments away. Actually, I think we have till 2:01, but we're moments away from 2:01, and we still need 10 calls to 888-694-6931 or 10 online contributions at kera.org.
The advantages of becoming a member are that you know that the programming that you count on and that you love will continue to be there. There is no other service that you probably use on a regular basis that you don't expect to pay for. And it may just be that you don't expect to pay for public radio because you don't pay for other kinds of radio. Except when you think about it, you really do. You're paying for it with your time, with all the amount of time that you end up spending listening to commercials and station breaks and things that don't really interest you. We try to strip all that away in public radio by coming directly to you only a few times a year. And quite frankly, even when we are doing a fundraising drive, there is still a great amount of time, more time spent in content, certainly on this show, than there is spent fundraising. We're really proud of that. It's only possible when you respond to our sincere request for financial assistance. The telephone number is 1-888-694-6931. You can also make a pledge online at kera.org.
Do your part, 888-694-6931, online at kera.org. This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA. Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, online at kera.org. Think about, if you thought about joining the station, if you've considered supporting it during this membership campaign, as I've said earlier in the week, if you thought, well, if they're still fundraising on Thursday, I'll do it then. Well, here we are. We're here. It's Thursday. Your contribution today can really help speed along the end of the drive, because the closer we get today, the less ground we have to cover tomorrow. And we can wrap this thing up. We are at $439,000 raised, Chris, at this point. That means there's just about $161,000 left to raise. We can get that much farther today. We could possibly wrap it up tomorrow.
You'd be surprised how fast contributions of $50 or $100 or $500 add up. Whatever you can contribute really does chip away at the overall goal. We've said this before, but we set those numbers based on the minimum amount of money that we need to get everything done the way you expect us to have it done. We want to make sure that we have the programming that you like. We want to make sure that we maintain professional standards. But we are not here to make additional amounts of money. We're just here to raise the money it takes to put the programming on the air that you rely on. The telephone number is 1-888-694-6931. You can also make a contribution at kera.org. If at some point you've heard us talking about a thank you gift and you thought, well, I would really like that in addition to making my contribution, they're all still available. Talk to the folks on the phone or check them out online, even if we're not talking about them. If that will make up your mind, go for it.
Yeah, probably the most popular thing in the last couple of days has been the Ken Burns, the National Park series. It's 6 DVDs. It's 12 hours of footage from the PBS television series you saw this past fall. And you can have that. That can be your very own for your collection, for your DVD collection, if you join the station right now at a level greater than at least $100 or greater. So give $100, give $200, or give $250 and ask for the Ken Burns DVD, National Parks DVD collection. But call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. Sorry if I'm not making sense, Chris.
You're making sense.
I know it's fifth hour of fundraising today. <so.
laughs> No, in fact, I'm amazed that you're still standing upright. We want to thank all of you who are calling. We are working on this challenge grant. Julia Pendery has offered $2,500 if we can get 100 contributions during the 2 hours of Think Today. You can make this possible. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Consider the value of public radio in your life. Consider what public radio, what listening to public radio says about you, the fact that you really value ideas and civil discourse and media that doesn't have to scream at you and doesn't try to tell you what to think. We're really proud to be able to provide that to you, and we are grateful that you recognize it and make a contribution. We truly, you know, this time out, we are asking everyone who listens to make a contribution. Now, for you, that may be a few dollars. You may be able to do a friend's membership at the $1,500 level. You know what your budget is, and you know how great it feels to support something you believe in.
1-888-694-6931. I do want to thank Julia Pendery for making the challenge grant today, $2,500. And thank everybody who has responded. And we are getting some news from Pledge Control Central, Chris.
We have made the challenge. Thank you all very much. If you're on the line, please don't hang up because
don't hang up.
We'll put that money into the next hour. We greatly appreciate your support. It's a wonderful thing. And that's an additional, thanks to you, an additional $2,500 for KERA.
Thanks to Judith Nikolai in Highland Village, Dr. Rick Davis in Midlothian, Texas, and Kelly Carvino in Fort Worth. Thank you very much, Kelly, for your contribution.
Thanks also Jeff Klein in Plano, Judy Garrett and Howard Garrett in Dallas, Diana Lynn in Arlington, and Jeannie Carpenter in Irving. Running out of time here, but we do want to thank you, Mundy Hendrickson and Joyce Leahy in Dallas. The number is 1-888-694-6931. You can also make your contribution online at kera.org. Thank you.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.